Robin Miller, welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, our week in IndyCar news for the week of March 23rd. Why March 23rd? Because we usually record this on a Thursday, and it's really just an arbitrary number. We didn't have any racing, obviously, this week, coming off of St. Pete a week and a half, almost 2 weeks ago. I did realize, though, that after recording our week in IndyCar news last week and reviewing St. Pete, because I was sitting in a little villa or whatever you want to call it in Sebring and half asleep because I was an idiot, I never discussed brakes. We didn't touch on brakes at all, which was kind of the big topic throughout St. Pete, capped off by your favorite and my all-time favorite press release from brake supplier Brembo, essentially threatening, we don't know what, litigation, you know, bust us in the kneecaps, I'm not sure what, but threatening anyone through this press release that disagreed or disparaged their name, or you, I mean, I've never seen anything like it, so maybe before we get to the on-track stuff in the race with the mixed Brembo brake calipers and performance friction discs and pads, tell me about that press release, Robin. That one deserves framing, doesn't it?
I told Paul Fanner you should get a raise because you got race. I think Racer Magazine, that's the first time they've ever been threatened in a press release. That's pretty cool. You just have to wonder, though, because, you know, you go back and read your stories. It was nothing you said. It was what the drivers were saying, well, we got big problems here, and this is, you know, I mean, you're just reporting what was going on. I think Honda and Chevy both spoke up, so it was definitely an issue, and I think didn't become such a big issue in the race because it was overcast and not nearly as hot as we thought it'd be. So that was good. And now I guess the big thing is everybody's worried about Long Beach because you use the brakes and it's so hot. But after that, I know a hell of a lot more about it than I do. But I mean, is this something that's going to happen? Is this going to go on all year? Are they going to find a fix for it? What do you think?
Well, I know what needs to happen. I just don't know if it's going to happen. One of two things. Either IndyCar needs to say, hey, we're going to performance friction in 2018 when they are ready to provide calipers to go with their discs, go with their pads. So it's a 100% solution from one company. Everything that's designed to work with one another from the outset. Either that needs to happen, just strictly go back to Brembo discs and pads with the same calipers that have been on the car since 2012. No one's loved them. They've been hated from day one because of their inconsistency and also their high wear rate, but at least they've worked. We've never heard drivers say the brakes don't work, they overheat, they failed, whatever it might be. Whether teams and drivers loved or hated Brembos, we haven't had this conversation about, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? Are people going to be crashing out? So one of two things, go back to what we know works, and then start from scratch next year with PFC, or let Chevy and Honda, and this is the other big thing, let Chevy and Honda develop whatever they want to develop for big old brake ducts on the road and street courses to make sure that cooling is not an issue. And that was really the heart of the issue here. So it might be bouncing around a little bit, but when IndyCar chose to freeze aero kits at the end of 2016, obviously both manufacturers bought into that. Yep, okay, we agree, let's do it. They signed off on it. IndyCar also said, well, hey, we're going to change brake vendors. Initially, it was expected. There was no announcement in the beginning that said we're going to keep half of the existing brake package and then introduce half new from a new company. It was performance friction coming in. And then that evolved into, well, it's going to be half. And we're going to go full PFC in 2018. Okay, that's got it, understood. The issue came in was IndyCar then locked and made both manufacturers stick to this aero kit freeze agreement. And early, even as far back as November, teams are saying, hey, we've got some cooling issues here. We seriously are struggling to keep these Brembo calipers cool. And there were requests made, I believe strictly from the Honda side at that point, to use some bigger ducting. We need to ram more air into the brake area to cool things down to make sure everything's kosher. That was denied. Then, finally, Keep in mind that PFC was working hard to supply every team with one set of friction material, that being the calipers and pads, about 2 weeks, 2.5, 3 weeks before the first round here in St. Pete, when everybody got them and everybody went testing and everybody went to that warm Sebring test. That's when things really started going haywire. We heard about one car, a good friend of ours, who had essentially had the caliper seals melt out of one of the rear calipers due to overheating, and luckily there was no fire, but some pretty scary stuff. And that's when the alarm bells were really raised with IndyCar, saying, guys, got it, aero kit freeze, blah, blah, blah. This has nothing to do with freeze. We're getting into safety here. You need to let us do something. And as we wrote about, they finally had a in-person meeting at St. Pete on Thursday of the event. IndyCar agreed with the assessment, allowed some modifications. It helped bring temperatures down, although there were still problems. And you and I spoke with a number of drivers. I think Graham Rahal might have been the angriest one of all, because brakes were just a constant problem for him throughout the event. But there was another cool change that happened. We had a development on Saturday where IndyCar allowed another modification to the rear brakes. They let the Honda teams add an extension to the lower portion of the rear brake ducting, essentially helping to grab more air. And that was, you know, widely praised, and the Honda teams and engineers that I spoke with, they said that really helped with the two changes allowed, one on Thursday and then the one on Saturday. Together, they really helped keep things in a safer range in the race. Although just about everybody I spoke to said, we're kind of at the limit. Like, you know, these changes helped, but it's not as if we brought everything down from the danger zone to things being cool and happy. This is about as far as we would want to see those temperatures go. So to your point, Robin, it was a little bit breezy on race day. It was definitely cooler. It was comfortable. Is it going to be like that when we get to Long Beach? Usually not. Southern California in April, usually a little bit warmer. So again, to me, it would be an unpopular thing with their new vendor, PFC, but either let the teams go back to what they know works with a full Brembo kit, or let Chevy and Honda do kind of whatever they want or whatever they feel they need to keep the brakes cool with this blended package by, I don't know if you want to say unfreezing the brake ducts, but again, this isn't about performance. This isn't about cost savings. This is about safety. So we did have cars on track this week, Robin. We had the Barber IndyCar test, the second official open test of the year. Good to see that Takuma Sato fast again. We almost had Chip Ganassi Racing's Max Chilton end the event as the fastest man until one William Power spoiled his party on the last lap after the checkered flag had waved. On 6 hours of testing, you were checking in, keeping an eye on things. I was as well. I love the fact that we didn't come out of Barber with a Honda as the fastest car. If we did have Hondas as the fastest, I don't know. I like the fact that Chevy, even though it was the last lap and it wasn't by much, I love the fact that it looks like we are going to have a proper scrap on our hands everywhere we go.
Well, yeah, especially when you look at Newgarden was third, Montoya was fourth. So, I mean, it's not like, I think Ed Carpenter said it best flying back from St. Pete. He goes, you know, it's one race. We'll see what's going on. He goes, I don't think, you know, he goes, I'm not concerned yet. So, it's the key is that, you know, 22 cars all, you know, within a second of each other, it's as usual. It's just interesting that in this day and age, I was looking through some old 70s, IndyCar magazines and stuff, and looking at the spreads in some of the fields. I mean, and obviously with spec cars and engines being pretty similar, it should be close. But to think that there's 22 cars within a second of each other, and if you're 0.3 off, you know, you're, instead of being 6th, you're 17th. So I just think the interesting thing about the competition in this series is that it's still hard to pick. It's not hard to say that Will Power is going to always throw a lap in and maybe steal the pole, because he's probably still the fastest guy in the series. But I do think it's hard to pick who's going to win the races, and that's what I like about it. And this test, it was pretty mixed. I mean, it was pretty scrambled. I mean, Charlie Kimball's slowest, and his teammates almost quick time, and in between you got Dixon seventh, and and you got Tony Kanaan. I think he was 11th or 12th. So, you know, I mean, it's they're all over the map right now. But and Bourdais was right in the middle. I think he was 13th or something like that. So, it seems like Andretti's found something for the most part. I mean, Marco was 5th again, which coming off as good as he practiced and raced at St. Pete, they've certainly found something. It looks like to me.
Yeah, and I also love the fact that Ed Jones was right there with our boy, Mr. Bourdais. So, and speaking with them, they are, you know, really impressed with how quickly Ed is taking to IndyCar. I don't think it's a surprise that Ed is a quick study, but, you know, you never exactly know, right? I mean, there are some kids that it takes them a year, takes them 2 years to figure it out. And then there are some where it looks like, you know, again, we're only one race and when, you know, this one road course test down, but it just looks like there's some who fully grasp what they need to do. And rather than going out and running into things and making an ass out of themselves, you know, drive with intelligence and, you know, show that this is an aptitude that they have, and hopefully they'll be there for a while. So,
yeah, you know, with Ed, I mean, he's got Mike Cannon as engineer. I don't think it can be, as you're a rookie, I don't think you could ask for a better person to try and get you indoctrinated in IndyCar racing.
Cannon indoctrination, it's something I know a lot about. All that aside, we also heard from Zach Veach, a kid that I think anybody who's met him, anybody who's seen him drive, infectious little bastard. I mean, he's about as big as my right leg, but man, that kid has some big muscles and big huevos as well. Hard racer, wasn't able to make the jump from 3 years, I think 2-3 years of Indy Lights into IndyCar this year to start the season at least, but great news to hear that he has found what appears to be a proper Indy 500 budget and is now in a position to be shopping for teams and closing in on deals compared to walking around begging with his hands out.
Well, I think it was last year at the Sonoma test when everybody's eyes got open because he did such a good job, and I think everybody thought, well, this guy, he's too small, he's not strong enough to drive an Indy car. He was funny after the test. He said, you know, I probably couldn't have gone 2 hours. That was, you know, I was a pretty, I gotta get in better shape than that, but you can't help but like him. And people are like, ah, no, that guy, he's too small. He looks like he's 12. Well, guess what? He stands on the button, and I hope it works out for him.
And if we look at not only where he's going, but some of the other young drivers too, some cool news last weekend wasn't IndyCar specifically, but it was a couple of badasses who are either in the series or hoping to get there at the 12 Hours of Sebring. You wrote about Spencer Pigot with the Ed Carpenter Racing Team. You and I both marveled at the drive he put in at St. Pete. That was unfortunately brought to a halt with a mechanical issue, but Spencer drove and showed the same kind of balls and bravado that made him a multiple champion on the Mazda road to Indy. We saw that at St. Pete, and I really think, you know, for the first time in IndyCar, you know, with just a handful of races, yeah, he demonstrated that, aha, all right, this kid is someone we need to really pay attention to. He goes down to Sebring to race with the Mazda prototype team and does the same thing. The full 3.7, kick your behind, you know, bumpy as can be, knock the fillings out of your teeth track in a bad fast prototype. And it was just like a continuation from St. Pete to Sebring for him. So cool to see what appears to be a groove for Spencer. Also a young American who is starting to come into his own. So love that. And then Pato O'Ward, 18-year-old Mexican kid, won the 24 Hours of Daytona in the PC prototype class, got a last-minute call to come to St. Pete, drive for Team Pelfrey, ends up on the podium in the second race, finishes third there, huge smile, wants to keep going, heads down to Sebring last weekend, and wins the 12 Hours of Sebring. So here's this kid who's never raced a prototype, 18 years old. We want to see him in IndyCar as soon as possible. This kid's already won 36 hours of endurance racing, Robin. I mean, it's just, again, I realize we're not talking about IndyCar, but I do love the fact that these kids, either on their off weekends or whatever it might be, they're doing like the old guard did, saying, all right, tell me where to go. I'll show up, and they're kicking ass.
Yeah, I think in Spencer's case, I think he's a very smart kid. He understands he's won at every level, been a champion everywhere. But it's a huge transition, especially when you're only part-time, and there are more road courses, street car races than ovals. But I think he understands as well as anybody that this is make it or break it time, and I think he's really committed to showing people, hey, I belong here, I'm going to stay because, I can drive these things. So, and the guy you discovered when we were standing there in the press room at St. Pete, he's obviously another guy that's hungry. That's what racing's all about. It's these kids that are trying to get somebody to pay attention to them that don't have any money, and they want somebody to give them a ride, and just give me a ride, give me a chance. And I think that's all Piggott really wanted.
So I need to apologize here a little bit, dear listeners. Last week in our Week in IndyCar, told you that we were expecting, teased something, that we were expecting to have a pretty cool breaking story to develop and share. Didn't happen. It was something both Robin and I were standing there and told about it at St. Pete. I have heard that the news is still coming. It's happening, but rather than it landing late last week as we thought, I actually don't have an exact update on when it's going to land, but it'll be a good one. I think folks will be happy when they do hear about it. So, those are the risks that come with trying to tease some things. I can add a new tease, though, and I actually haven't even told you about it, Robin, so I'll give you the full scoop once we're done here, but I got a text from someone who competed in the Mobile One 12 Hours of Sebring, who said, hey, I have a sponsor, and I have a budget, and want to do the Indy 500. Do you know of any teams or who I might speak to for those that might have something open or might have an interest? And this is someone who's never competed at the Indy 500 or an IndyCar. So might be able to write about that soon. Might not. So again, I'm not teasing exactly when that might come to light, but hopefully you can write about it soon. But I love things like that. And Robin, you get those too, right? Hey, I got something going. Who should I talk to? What's brewing? And, especially when they come out of left field, I looked at my phone. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. I really would have never expected that guy to try and make the 500. But and he is someone who has a history of being able to find money. So it wasn't received as just a smoke and nonsense kind of text. So that's
mechanics have always been my best source. And, I got a call a couple days ago and said, hey, it's a slam dunk. Zach Veach is, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, slam dunk. He's in an Andretti. He's in the fifth car. And then Monday or Tuesday, somebody called and said, nah, he's going to go to Floyd. And then you wrote the story. And it's like, it's somebody in there, he's going to take that money. One of them, and maybe Ed Carpenter. There's like three people vying for that money.
And it's a good thing that there are some teams able to receive some money. So I don't know, and I think we could get Zach on here, and he's a pretty straight shooter. He'd even say, I don't know where I'm going to put pen to paper, but it does sound like he does have the money to do that, so that is pretty awesome, and he could have someone else new to play with here. All right, we're gonna go in left field, which for those who listen to the other episodes of the Marshall Pruitt podcast, you know that left field is kind of where I live half the time. So my favorite story of the week, Robin, was on ESPN. It was on the True Hoop portion of their site, which is dedicated to basketball. And it was about the hidden but most popular type of food among NBA players, and that's peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And they traced the lineage of this love and passion back to Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce at the Boston Celtics, and how they essentially made them mandatory food, pregame food, warm-up food, postgame food, the carbohydrates from the bread, the sugar from the peanut butter and jelly. Long story short, this started to get around the league. Now, essentially, every team, every player. It's just peanut butter and jelly sandwiches nonstop. This is the power food for the LeBron James and the Steph Currys and the you name it in the NBA. And it got me to thinking about, you've known enough drivers, enough crew members. You probably worked with people when you were in IndyCar who had some weird food habits, digestive needs, and otherwise. I know I worked with a guy, a refueler, Bob, who I worked with for a couple years. Sweetheart of a guy. He drank Pepsi. And I know I'm talking to a Pepsi drinker here. But when I say Bob drank Pepsi, I mean he drank Pepsi. Hey, Bob, you want some water? No. Hey, Bob, you want... No. Want some milk? No. Pepsi. Not... What did he have in the morning? Pepsi. All day long. That is all the man drank. Refused, with pride, to put any other liquid in his body. I have to believe you've come across some, and especially knowing the dinners you have with your friends in lunches and otherwise, I'm sure you've come across some people with some either interesting or peculiar dietary habits in IndyCar.
I think probably the one guy that always stood out for me was Emerson Fittipaldi, because he's the first guy I ever saw have his own chef within like during the month of May, and he it was some kind of steamed goulash that looked like Brazilian. I was the most unedible looking stuff I've ever seen, but that was what he, and he had it in a little sealed bag, and that's all he ever ate. And I tried to get him to go to the Mug and Bun once, and he obviously declined. I did take Stephanie Johansson to Mug and Bun once. He tried a red tenderloin, and he called me 2 weeks later and said, "What was in that thing I ate?" And I said, "Well, it's a lot of grease." He goes, "Well, it's still in my stomach." I said, "It'll digest. Just relax."
And he brings that up half the time when we see him about it. Still,
right.
20 years still,
but
in his body.
You know, in the '60s and seventies, everybody ate racetrack hamburgers and hot dogs. There was no hospitality until Jim Chapman came along in the '80s with PPG, and they had the PPG tent. That's the first time they ever had something besides track dogs. So I don't know that there's any. I know there's a former Indy winner that used to get a loaf of bread, and he would take the four slices out of the middle and throw the rest of it away. That's a little strange.
That four, not three. He didn't throw away the ends. He grabbed
four slices in the middle. Threw the rest of the bread away.
I never thought Buddy Lazier would do that. No, kidding aside.
that's our boy.
Well, but I mean, granted, there's those who might have peculiar dietary habits, and then there's your single-handed efforts to ruin the digestive tracts of rookies, foreign drivers, you name it, by bringing them to the Indiana State Fair and funneling every dead, run over, shot, murdered, hung, breaded, triple fried, chop sueyed animal on the planet. Tell me about some of the other poor bastards. I mean, the Mug and Bun's one thing. That is a great lifetime supply of grease in a single meal. But tell me about some of the food you have introduced our friends to at the State Fair of the years.
I just remember we tried to get Pagano to eat a deep-fried Twinkie, and he passed, and then we tried to get him to eat an elephant ear, and he didn't like that looks of that either, and I can't remember what he ended up. But Kanan was the one that really took to the State Fair. He tried everything and liked about half of it. So I'm trying to think. Willpower was, he was pretty finicky. There wasn't too many things he liked. One year he went with us. But it's always fun to take, you know, the guys like Aloshin or somebody like that, and, you know, he's pretty brave on the racetrack, but he's pretty brave at the State Fair. He tries a little bit of everything, and, you know, I said, "Are there state fairs in Russia?" And he just laughed. He goes, "No, not like this." So, you know, probably the greatest one is when I worked at ESPN. We had that show RPM Tonight, and I took Bruno Junqueira and Nick Manassian, who were driving for Ganassi, to
Quick
the Mug
Nick.
And Bun. Manassian loved everything, and Bruno hated everything, and it was just the expressions on Bruno's face when he would try a deep fried cheese tater tot were pretty funny. too bad we didn't. I hope somebody's got that tape somewhere. It's pretty funny to watch again.
So that's the reason behind the lifetime of constipation he's dealt with. All right, well, that's good. We'll
that's it.
Maybe we will find a way to dislodge that cheese-fried tater tot. All right, Miller. Well, we're getting to the end here. This is our traditional Thursday evening taping slot. You and the amazingly loud but beloved Steve Shunk are headed to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the morning. We have some IndyCar testing there. It's a Honda test. It's also other teams, so there'll be Chevy teams as well, but it's a manufacturer test for Honda. I can't wait to see what happens.
How does that work with the Honda test? I saw the Penske guys are going to be. How does that work? Do they share the expense?
Well, not only expense, but IndyCar sets up their testing structures to say you get so many these kinds of days and that kinds of days. Teams have a certain amount of, call them independent test days, where they can go, you know, wherever they want and test. Then there are also manufacturer test days where IndyCar says, all right, you know, Chevy and Honda, you both get X amount where you can do your own thing. And in those instances, the two manufacturers pick and choose which team or teams they want to have them help them with whatever they're looking to test. So, you know, it's, I don't want to say it's a weird thing, but there are a couple agendas that'll be going on there. That, to me, though, is the interesting thing we're going to find out to some degree tomorrow. Obviously, Honda was loving the Super Speedways last year. That's where they were able to flex their muscles. It'd be interesting to see with this aero kit freeze, and especially knowing how hot and badass their motors were at St. Pete to start off this season, if we're going to see some really impressive speeds come tomorrow, and also what Chevy has. You know, keep in mind that in terms of how IndyCar's engine regulations work, you have to mileage out motors, get to 2,500 miles before you can switch to the next one in the lease. The way the timing has tended to work, Robin, is teams will get those motors just before the start of the year, use them a little bit in testing, do the races leading up to the Indy 500, often even use that motor through the GP of Indy, and then switch to something fresh when we get to the oval portion of the month of May. And it's when we get to those second engines where development comes in. What we're going to see tomorrow is just a reflection of these first-generation engines for the season, meaning whatever teams had, both Chevy and Honda, for power at St. Pete is what we're going to see during this test. Now, when we come back for the month of May and we start getting up on the big oval, that's where we're going to see all the work that's been done by both brands to try and catch up or make gains, having seen how things played out early in the year. So I would just say that whatever speeds come out of Indy tomorrow, they would not necessarily be an indicator of what's going to happen when we do get to the month of May, because both brands are going to be working on getting more ponies into those motors. And we think, at least based on St. Pete, and also based on this Barber test, that Chevy has a little bit of catch up to do. So anyways, look forward to that. You're going to send over some videos for me to turn around. And other than that, brother, we are at the end of another week in IndyCar news. Thanks for everyone who listens. Don't be afraid to send in some questions or give us some topics to chop up or argue about. That's one thing Rob and I love to do, is argue. So anyways, I got nothing else, Miller. You got anything else?
That's it, brother. I'll talk to you tomorrow.